G'day and welcome everybody to another Bloody Movie Podcast. I am Sean Coates. Thanks very much for listening into what is a great time of year. It is the Melbourne International Film Festival. It has kicked off here in Melbourne. We are 3 or 4 days into it. I've lost count already. I've already seen a number of films. That's partly the reason why we have a podcast today. I'm going to be doing a little audio diary of the films that I have caught at the Melbourne International Film Festival thus far. The first half dozen or dozen, however many I've seen. Again, I have lost count. But to begin, and there's going to be more episodes like this over the course of the festival, and even, you know, just after the film festival, because there is MIFF Play. The festival will continue online once the in-cinema part of the festival is over, so there's still plenty more movies to go around. But before we get into the MIFF things, the MIFF happenings, we have to talk about one of the new releases of the week, and that is, of course, the brand new film, or as the poster describes it, the American Empirical Picture from the great Wes Anderson, his new film, Asteroid City. So, as I just mentioned, Asteroid City is the new film from the great Wes Anderson, and it stars all of Hollywood. You know, whenever Wes makes a film, the skies are dark, for all the stars are in the latest Wes Anderson picture, their latest American Empirical Picture, as I just described. And just looking at the poster, here are the names on it. This film stars Jason Schwartzman, Scarlett Johansson, Tom Hanks, Jeffrey Wright, Tilda Swinton, Bryan Cranston, Edward Norton, Adrian Brody, Liev Schreiber, Hope Davis, Stephen Park, Rupert Friend, Maya Hawke, Steve Carell, Matt Dillon, Hong Chow, Willem Dafoe, Margot Robbie, Tony Revolori, Jake Ryan, and Jeff Goldblum to round out that incredibly, incredibly stacked lineup of performers that are in this movie. And, you know, he brings all of Hollywood out for his films, out to Spain or wherever they shot this film. But this is his new film. It takes place in the titular town of Asteroid City, where a photojournalist named Augie Steenbeck, who's played by Jason Schwartzman, arrives for to take his son to a junior stargazer / space cadets convention in the titular town. He's a widower, he's just lost his wife, and you know, he's sort of dealing with the grief of that whilst trying to break the news to his kids, but then also trying to deal with it himself in this way. And when he's there, he meets one of the parents of another one of the children of the stargazing convention, which is an actress named Midge Campbell, a famous but world-weary actress, as the plot synopsis here describes. She's played by Scarlett Johansson. And there's a whole different other bunch of cast of characters. You've got, as I've mentioned, you have that entire cast list there. Rupert Friend plays like a cowboy musician. You've got Tilda Swinton as this sort of manic scientist, Jeffrey Wright as this military general, you've got Steve Carell as like the motel operator who is selling plots of land out of a vending machine. It's crazy stuff. And then during the Stargazers convention, it is rudely interrupted by First Contact, of all things. Now, I love Wes Anderson. I mean, what sort of cinephile would you be if you didn't, you know? And I mean, thinking back to some of the films that I've watched from him, like, I like almost all of them. And even though I wouldn't consider myself like a Wes Anderson diehard or a true Weshead or whatever they call his group of fans, he has developed this sort of, I guess, this sort of cultural cachet of being, even though he is he has those sorts of art house sensibilities and he's a very sort of esoteric filmmaker, he does have that sort of commercial appeal, or that general appeal. Maybe that's just because of the, you know, the ridiculous cast he gets in his films, but I guess there's something about his films that, you know, audiences, you know, even if they're into film or not, they genuinely latch onto. And, you know, that can be a double-edged sword, because I feel like a lot of his films are criticized for being, you know, like, they're being very surface level, and just, you know, there's not much past the symmetrical photography and the pastel colors and like all the quirky sort of humor and things like that, which I've never really subscribed to. I think his films, a lot of the time, you know, I feel like they're really emotional a lot of the time. And the fact that a lot of his films center around young protagonists, I feel like it unlocks something. And, you know, the way his films look, they almost look like they're out of a memory in a way. And that's a big part of Asteroid City, I find, and what Wes is going for here. I'll get more into that in just a moment. But I feel like this, I think it's strange, but it's great that a filmmaker like Wes Anderson can have this sort of, this not quite a mass appeal, but can have an appeal outside of the cinema community. And, you know, that's fantastic. And seeing some of the reviews for Asteroid City, this feels like a film that is going to get better over time. Now, a lot of the reviews, I think, have been mixed to positive, and, like, I don't think it's being considered, like, a top-tier Wes Anderson film. And as it sits with me currently, I'm not too sure where it sits with me right now, but I think there is some complete, like, there is some amazing things in this film. Firstly, I might as well get started by saying the description that I gave you before, that's only really half of the film. So everything that I described, the whole Stargazers convention, the 1950s, you know, the whole sort of 50s sci-fi, the retro-futurist sort of stuff, that is all a play that is being put on by both Edward Norton's writer character, I believe his name is Conrad Earp, and then also Adrian Brody's character, who as I think is Shubert Green. And they are putting on this play, and Bryan Cranston as this sort of narrator is sort of guiding you through. It's almost showing the artistic this fictional artistic process to put on this this movie that you're seeing, or in the world of the film, this play that you're seeing. And it's fascinating watching the film, and because the way that these two, which for the most part are quite separate in terms of plot, there's a few things that go over, mainly with Jason Schwartzman's character and to a lesser extent Scarlett Johansson's, them sort of intersecting and becoming one. And even though this came out in the US before Oppenheimer and Barbie did, this movie, you know, next to Margot Robbie is in it for literally one scene. And it has a weird similarity with Oppenheimer as well, because all of the stuff that isn't the play is in black and white, and all of the other stuff is this very, sort of very saturated, very, very bright sort of colours in the Asteroid City play. Genuinely not expecting those sorts of similarities between these films. But as I was saying about this film, I feel like it's Wes Anderson probably at his most open and vulnerable and sort of interrogating his own sensibilities as an artist in a really, really compelling and really disarming way. And I feel that's really fitting for a film about these people who are in search of knowledge and this sort of quest to explain what cannot be explained, and, you know, looking for meaning, like, in many different ways, not just the people within the narrative of the Asteroid City play, but also the actor of, like, Jason Schwartzman's character, what was his name, Augie Steenbeck, or his actor's name, which I believe is Jones Hall, him going through this sort of grief, like, feeling the grief of his character almost as a way of coping with a grief in his own life. There's points in the film where he sort of, in the world of the play, will sort of break the fourth wall and be like, I don't understand what I'm doing. Like, I don't understand, like, not necessarily his character's motivation, but, like, why am I doing this? Like, and, you know, his sort of, his own life and the life of his character are starting to intersect in a way there. And it's just a really, it becomes this really profound statement on art, and as a way, as, like, this sort of, it's this beautiful sort of encapsulation of art as like almost a coping mechanism to get you through the incredibly difficult parts of your life. But also Anderson doing that in a way that also interrogates his own sort of, his own sensibilities as an artist. And I think that's just absolutely incredible. Wes is an incredibly unique and very, as I said, esoteric filmmaker. But I feel like this film probably might be the most of, at least I think I've seen all of his films except The Royal Tenenbaums, which a lot of people seem to say is his best film, but I feel like this is probably the most esoteric of the bunch. Like, it does have all of those Anderson hallmarks, as I said, like the very painterly cinematography, the very stagey set design, you know, in this case intentionally so, like the very symmetrical imagery, the very bright colours, the pastels, all that sort of stuff, the quirky humour. I mean, it's the sight gags. Oh my god, the sight gags in this film, they're incredible. There's one of the other junior space cadets is like, He's like, I guess, desperate for attention, is just constantly asking people to dare him to do something, and he'll just do it just out of complete impulse. And there's this one great scene where, like, he gets a chili, and it's like, dare me to eat this chili. He eats it off screen. You don't see this character for about 20 seconds. Then, you know, the camera then sort of, you know, pans over to Steve Carell's motel where there's, like, a water cooler there. And then about 30 seconds later, you'll see this kid running in and grabbing a drink from the water cooler. And I mean, it's just, he's an expert at that, like, you know, like a master of, you know, not only framing but blocking, just like using the actors in this scene. And you know, it's all in service of not just this sort of the metatextual narrative that the film is going for, you know, the play within the film, within, you know, it doing that, but it's also, you know, bringing like this meta self-reflection of his own sensibilities of an artist, you know, like confronting the artifice of his own work in ways that I don't entirely have a full grasp on, but I feel like that's kind of the meaning of the film. Like, if you go in search of meaning, you won't find it. You have to sort of let it find you. And that's, I feel like with this film, is something that you are going to be continually rewarded with on rewatches. And I feel like that's what the film, you know, very pointedly is actively telling you at certain points, you know, like, there's a line in the film, it's like, you know, where Jason Schwartzman's character doesn't understand what he's doing. And it's like, you don't have to understand it, just keep telling the story. Which in a way I feel like is sort of Wes Anderson maybe addressing certain criticisms about his own past work, but is also, I feel like, is almost like the ethos of his filmography, I guess, you know? And I feel like with this film, he really opens up and reveals a lot about himself. And even though I can't really articulate it much into words, I found that just beautiful. Like, it's a beautiful film that will just reward you with continuous rewatches. And yeah, I could easily see this, because of that very reason, I could easily see this becoming my favorite Wes Anderson film over time. And yeah, that's Asteroid City. It is in Australian cinemas from this Thursday, August 10th. But if you live in any other territories, you've definitely got it before us. And especially if you're in the US, you probably already own it on Blu-ray at this point. So, you know, give it a rewatch and take yourself on this journey to find the meaning in Asteroid City. It's a wonderful, wonderful film. One of Wes's best. Alright, now, time to get into what I have seen so far at the Melbourne International Film Festival. It is currently day 5 of the film festival overall. I am recording this on Monday, the 7th of August. I was meant to be seeing 3 films tonight, but after a day of work and having to record these podcasts, I've decided to take some leave from the Melbourne International Film Festival and talk to you fine folks about the 13 films I have currently seen. I have seen 9 in cinemas, and thanks to the great people at MIFF, they have given me access to some screeners, and I have watched 4 of those, so let's not waste any more time. Let's get into them. First film, Time Bomb, Y2K. So this is a HBO-produced documentary, I believe. I don't know if it's a Max original or just a HBO documentary, but yeah, this is a documentary about Y2K. It is made completely out of archival footage, excluding some animated sort of interstitials that sort of tie things together. But other than that, all completely archived material of already existing footage, and it's this just genuinely a collage of hysteria and madness that was going on, and presenting sort of like the countdown to the year of 2000, as the title suggests, like it was this sort of ticking time bomb. And as you sort of watch these clips of like news reports and all these other things in succession, where it sort of starts out as this problem that everyone's ignoring, where, you know, so Y2K, for people who don't know, was this sort of fear that, or this idea, this concept that, because as a cost-cutting measure, a lot of computers were manufactured in a very fatal design flaw, that their internal calendars, the years, did not have 4 digits, they only had 2. So that meant that, and they knew it was a problem too, but that meant that in the year 2000, once it hits 2000, the computers would not be able to tell the year 2000 from the year 1900. and they believe that would cause some malfunctions of and like losses of data, and like it would maybe even cause entire systems to shut down. Like, you know, you might have remembered hearing people like, you know, the lights will go out forever, planes will fall from the sky, and all this sort of nonsense, and, you know, all this fear-mongering crap, which, you know, was, you know, it was even, there's that famous episode of Family Guy, which there is a clip of in this film that sort of, that sort of made fun of that. And yeah, it is this sort of, this collage of madness that was, that this sort of, that this moment in time, you know, brought up. And it's fascinating at the start of this thing that, like, the people who are the most sort of adamant of, like, you need to take this seriously, as you get closer towards 2000 and, you know, they're actually making progress and trying to solve the issue and, you know, trying to reprogram computers so that Y2K won't happen, that's actually when the sort of hysteria becomes its most palpable. Like, you know, that's when sort of the right wing sort of take over and like religious groups sort of take over. And yeah, it becomes this sort of cataclysmic event in their eyes. And the film itself, yeah, is this really, really informative and really bizarre encapsulation of this moment in time. But then, you know, it's then it weirdly, as the film progresses and you actually get to when the midnight ticks over on January 1st, 2000, it becomes this almost joyous celebration of, like, Y2K, even though it was thought to be the end of the world, like, and, you know, you have people panic buying, all these sorts of things, and, you know, it's eerily reminiscent of COVID, like, this sort of hysteria that wraps around, like, it's very, very reminiscent of COVID, which I feel like that's what the filmmakers were really tapping into when they were making this film. And but when it gets to 2000 and Y2K obviously doesn't happen, because, you know, we're sitting here today, I'm recording this onto a computer, podcasts exist, you know, yeah, it becomes almost this joyous celebration of almost the entire world coming together for like the end of the century and, you know, heading into a new millennium. And it's a, you know, a beautiful sort of encapsulation of that. You know, it's a fascinating documentary. It's only 84 minutes, so yeah, definitely get around Y2K if you can. As I said, it is a HBO original documentary, so I'm sure it'll be coming screening on HBO in the US at some point, and then on Max, or, you know, here in Australia it might be on Foxtel or Binge at some point, or maybe it will get a theatrical release or something. But yeah, seek this out if you're interested in this subject matter. It's a compelling watch. And the next film I'm going to talk about is Shut Eye, a new film from just across the Tasman over in New Zealand. This is from what I can tell, the feature debut of writer-director Tom Levesque. And because I don't recall seeing any New Zealand Film Commission or any film financing bodies at the beginning of the credits, so I'm assuming to believe that this was either self-financed or crowdfunded. So congratulations on, you know, getting your film made. But this is a film, a sort of a psychological, I hate to say thriller or I hate to say thriller because it's not really a thriller. It has thriller elements, but it's more of a drama sort of a film. But it follows this sort of girl in her early to mid 20s. She's a university dropout, but she's still living on a university campus. She is in a really tough transitional point in her life. She works for a charity and she hates her job. She has incredibly low self-esteem. She doesn't appear to have many friends at all. And she's incredibly, incredibly socially isolated. And to top all of that off, she's suffering from insomnia. And one day when her GP recommends her to try ASMR to help her get to sleep, she comes across this website and of ASMR streamers. And then she becomes like sort of an online companion of sorts with one streamer named Kate, who has this very soothing voice and is almost like the first person to ever really notice her in a way. So naturally, she becomes quite fixated on this very quickly. The two become friends. They end up meeting. They're both in the same town in New Zealand. I don't think it's specified, but I believe it's Auckland. And they become very, very close friends, but then that friendship can then, as I said, it becomes this fixation and it very quickly turns into obsession. And this film does have some really good commentary and very timely commentary, especially just coming out of COVID. Like, the film that it reminded me most of was not quite as much, but the film Private Chat with Uncut Gems girl. Why am I blanking on her name? I want to say Megan Fox, Julia Fox, not Megan Fox. That was a film that sort of dealt with isolation in the age of the internet, and watching that on a computer screen during COVID felt very fitting. And you know what, I unfortunately didn't get to watch this one in a cinema. I watched this on a screener, and like, there's a similar sort of impact that this film sort of has, and like, the way this film sort of explores these almost parasocial relationships and, you know, the what they can sort of do to a mind, essentially, especially a mind that is in a very vulnerable state of mind. It's a really, really interesting exploration of that. But then the film sort of turns into more of a thriller sort of aspect of it. And when it's sort of centering around something as low energy as ASMR, it's not really a good match. And, you know, some of the sort of progressions of the plot that happen here, I'm not going to say they're not far-fetched, but they're just like not entirely believable for something these characters would do. And the movie did sort of lose me a little bit in its last 30 minutes or so. But yeah, other than that, it's a decent film. I wasn't huge on it, but this is a good little, you know, New Zealand indie film that I hope does well. And I want to give a shout out to the lead actress, Millie Von Cole, I believe her name is, who played the lead character, whose name is Sierra, I'm just remembering now, because she's not named after the Spanish word for mountain, but rather after her mum's car, who had a Ford Sierra, so not quite as eloquent as you would think. But yeah, Millie Von Cole is the name of the actress, and she's great. Like, in the early scenes, you know, this film, as I said, for a film that has what looks to be like a very, very small budget, it's shot incredibly well, and it uses 4x3 cinematography as well. And specifically, a lot of this film is played on close-ups, and specifically Millie Von Cole's face in the early scenes in particular, where she is, you know, this insomniac, just like, you know, like walking around looking like she's half dead, essentially. And it's just, you know, she just nails every single one of these, every single one of those expressions. And it really tells you so much about this character, who doesn't really speak that much in the early parts of the film. But like, you know, she brings a lot to the role just with her facial expressions. And, you know, Levesque, the film cinematographer, does an excellent job in sort of conveying that, you know, visually. And yeah. Yeah, so I wasn't huge on this film, but I'm definitely not going to, I'm not going to persuade others to not see it. And if people do want to check this out at the festival, it is screening on Friday, August 11th at 9 p.m. at the Kino Cinemas on Collins Street. And again, also at the Kino on Collins Street on Sunday, the 13th of August at 6:45. And to give you a little more incentive to go to those screenings, both the director Tom Levesque and the actress who plays Kate, Sarah May, will be at both of those screenings, so make sure you get down to them. And just a note, why I haven't said any of those for Time Bomb Y2K is because by the time this episode comes out, both of the screenings would have already happened. So unless you're a time traveler, you won't be able to go see those, unfortunately. But keep an eye out for Time Bomb Y2K, and also Shuteye, if it does get further distribution outside of the festival. But on to the next film. The next film we have is Passages, the new film from Ira Sachs, who is a filmmaker that I've heard amazing things about, but this was my introduction to him. And this is a film starring Franz Rogowski, Ben Whishaw, and the amazing Adele Exarchopoulos. Franz Rogowski plays a German filmmaker living in Paris. He's very much a Fassbinder type in more ways than one. His partner is Ben Whishaw. I believe his name's Martin. His name is Thomas. Franz Rogowski's name is Thomas. And he's a filmmaker. He's just completed a new film. But he's becomes enchanted by this teacher, a woman named Agatha, who is played by Adele Exarchopoulos. And this sort of love affair begins. And it's a very sensual, very riveting sort of seesawing power dynamics, and just watching Franz Rogowski's character, who just continually makes the wrong decisions at every single point and every turn of the film. Like, so many people online have already jokingly said that this film, sorry to Joachim Trier, but this film really should be called The Worst Person in the World. A lot of people have already made that joke. And yeah, Franz Rogowski, it's just another one of those films where it's about a compellingly awful person that just makes so many terrible decisions, but you just cannot take your eyes off them. That's Franz Rogowski in this film. He's great. Ben Whishaw is also fantastic, as is Adele Exarchopoulos. You know, seesawing power dynamics, as I said, and like really a lot, like sexual tension out the wazoo. It's a really, really good film. I'm not too familiar with Iris Sack's work. So, from what I understand, he's like sort of making these films that feel very European within a very American context. But now that he's gone over to Europe, it feels like his sensibilities as a filmmaker really match this sort of material. And yeah, I like Passages quite a bit. It is one of the headlining films of the festival, and, you know, it's sure to attract a really big audience, this film. Passages has one more screening on Friday, August 18th at 9:45 p.m. at the Comedy Theatre. So make sure you all head along to that if you are at the festival. And the last film that I saw as a screener before the festival proper was the Australian film Bird Eater. Now, I selected this film in the fantasy draft I did with B. Jermaine and Chris Evans, and is so far the only film from the draft that I have seen. No, that is not true. I saw another one. I'll get to that one later. But Bird Eater, to start off with, I was very much looking forward to this film. As I described in the draft, it's sort of a, you know, it's a more modern take on that sort of Wake and Fright model, addressing more contemporary themes of masculinity and gender politics in a really sort of interesting, confronting, but also in this film's case, a very, very dark and intense sort of way. The basic setup for this film is that there's a young couple, they've just got engaged. They decide his friends throw the groom a bucks party out in the middle of nowhere on, like, I think on an island out there somewhere. But in a strange turn of events, the girlfriends of all the men are invited to the bucks party as well, because it's supposedly progressive and cool. And from there, it begins into a very tense, dark, and just really, yeah, confronting descent into hell, essentially. Like, this film, as you know, it becomes very tense, and then cue the uninvited guests or people who were invited but didn't tell anyone else, and that causes tensions, and everybody has a secret, and they all sort of get revealed, and that just increases the tension more, and then it just all builds to what is just probably, this movie is the reason I love Australian genre cinema. And look, if you are going to invoke Wake and Fright, which I was unsure when I picked this film for the draft, I was unsure whether the filmmakers actually did, but reading the filmmaker's description, and also very early on in the film where somebody has a Wake and Fright poster in their room, which begs the question why they aren't going like, hey, this is all feeling a little bit familiar to that movie that I really like. Later in the film, it all begs the question. But no, if you're going to invoke Wake and Fright, you better, you know, hold a candle up to it. You don't have to match it, but you really have to bring something, and this movie really brings it. I don't want to say too much more, because, you know, this is one of the most anticipated of the festival. It's incredibly good. Umbrella will be releasing this. They have distribution. Hopefully they'll be releasing this sometime in the future. As it currently stands, both of the sessions of Bird Eater are sold out. But reading the press release from MIFF a couple of days ago, because the session sold out so quickly, they will hopefully be adding another one in the next. They will hopefully be adding another one later in the festival, and hopefully that will be announced in the coming days. But as a seasoned MIFF expert, I can give you a little bit of a hint. So there are currently two screenings that are there. At this point in time, they are both sold out. They are on Saturday, the 12th of August at 9 p.m. at the Kino, and again at the Kino at Monday, the 14th of August at 8:45 p.m. But keep an eye, just a little tip here, keep an eye on those sessions, because that little red standby thing, They, on the day of the, those sessions, they could turn yellow and selling fast because people will swap in and out of sessions all the time at these festivals. And this goes for all films as well. So just keep an eye on those ones and, you know, watch it like a hawk throughout the day or throughout like the coming hours before the session, and you might be able to sneak in a ticket. But as I said, the last Miss press release that I read said that they are planning to add an encore screening of this film, hopefully later in the festival, and also for the other Australian film, Sunflower, which sold out almost just as quickly as this film. So, yeah, keep an eye out for those if you want to see this film, and I highly recommend that you do that.
Quick editor's note here from Sean. As just before the morning that I was posting this on Wednesday, the 9th of August, the Melbourne International Film Festival has added a third screening of Bird Eater along with a number of other films. So the third screening of Bird Eater will now be at the Forum on Wednesday, August 16th at 6:45. As it stands now, it is not sold out, so get around it, get your tickets right now.
I will also just say that the screener that I watched was had work in progress elements to it, so I'm not too sure from the version that's going to be shown in cinemas how different it will be from what I saw. Like from what I said, there was like a work in progress color grade, like a couple of visual effects, you know, like work in progress credits, and I think even some like temp tracks. So the music, even though I think the sound design and the music in the film is excellent, like that might have just been the temp stuff. So if they got music that sounds that's even more, you know, like foreboding and really just makes you grip the arms of your chair until you rip them off, like that would be. You know, I'm keen to see it. Like this, I really wish I'd seen this with an audience. And yeah, if tickets become available for a next session, I'll absolutely try to get to it. So yeah, definitely check this film out, guys. Especially if you love genre cinema, if you love Aussie cinema, get around this. But obviously, it's not for the faint of heart. And on to the films that I saw from the cinemas of Melbourne International Film Festival. I opened my in-cinema MIF journey with Christian Petzold's new film, A Fire, which I believe won the Silver Bear for Grand Jury Prize at Berlinale this year. I'm not too familiar with Petzold's films. Everyone tells me Phoenix and Transit are, you know, two incredibly, you know, excellent, excellent films. I did see his most recent film, Undina, which I really, really liked. I thought it was, you know, a very contemporary and modern sort of spin on, like, you know, a German folklore and, like, you know, a German fairy tale in a way, and doing it within a modern, almost like real, like grounding it in realism was incredible, like something that I haven't seen done before, really. And, you know, that was a film that also had the great Franz Rogowski. He's not in it this time, but Petzold regular Paul LaBeer is in this film. It's about two art students who are on sort of a holiday. They go to the holiday house on the coast of somewhere in Germany. I can't remember. I always thought Germany was landlocked. But they go to this estate for the summer. Both of them are art students. One's a photographer, the other a writer. And it's just them sort of hanging out in this house while just kilometers away there's a forest fire raging, but they just aren't worrying about it. And I, from what I've seen of Petzold and from what I understand from his filmmaking, I was not expecting a film like this from him, because this, for the most part, is quite a breezy, light, you know, comedy, essentially, or light dramedy in a way. And, I feel like a big stumbling block for this film for a lot of people will be the main character, who is just the mopiest fuckhead incel you will ever see in a film. He is so dreadfully unlikable, and, you know, to ground the movie with him, like, I don't think he's not meant to be likable, like, and I don't think the film wants you to like him anyway, although I feel like the ending, you know, not to reveal it or anything, tries to, and then it kind of feels a little bit undeserved, but, and feels almost like a betrayal of the rest of the film that you've seen. But yeah, I found him although absolutely despicable, it was just compelling, because the movie is constantly beating down on him. Like, he's the very serious creative of everyone in this house, but then he finds out everyone else that tries to be creative is more interesting and better than him at it. And that sort of that just the jealousy and just absolute almost contempt that he has for everyone around him is genuinely great. And that's where a lot of the humor in this film comes from. And, you know, it does start to get a little bit more serious. You know, the fires start getting closer and closer and like start to pose a real danger that they've just all sort of flippantly said, nah, it's okay. The wind's pushing it in another direction. We'll be fine. You know, I guess there's some sort of commentary about sort of, I guess, climate change and like people's, you know, brazen attitudes towards it there. But yeah, mostly just a very light dramedy that, you know, takes itself, that does have a bit more depth and has a bit of an edge to it. I liked it quite a bit. I'm interested to see where everyone else lies on this, especially fans of Petzold, because I don't think this is what people usually expect from him. So, and there are two more screenings of the film at the festival. There is one that is currently at time of recording that is selling fast at 11:15 a.m. on Friday, August 18th at Acme, and a second one on the final day of the in-person in the in-cinema festival on Sunday, August 20th at 12:45 at the Capitol. So, and Mad Men Entertainment are distributing this one, so perhaps it will get a cinema release in the coming months or maybe within the next 12 months. So, yeah, keep an eye out for it. And the next film that I'm going to talk about is a Hungarian animation film called White Plastic Sky. A science, like an E, again, like sort of dealing with, you know, environmentalist themes and, you know, themes of the future and climate change and everything. This takes place 100 years in the future where Budapest has, like, because of some sort of either natural disaster, probably climate change, all life on Earth essentially can't live. Like, it's gotten to the point where human bodies are essentially a commodity. So 100 years in the future, in the year 2123, there's a titular white plastic sky over the city of Budapest where it's under a dome where everybody lives. They have holographic trees, like self-driving cars, pretty much in like a silicon paradise, a silicon utopia that they're all living in. But there is a Logan's Run-esque catch to this thing where when you turn 50, you're only allowed to live for 50 years. And once you turn 50, you have to essentially sacrifice yourself. You get taken to this place called the Plantation, where you essentially get an implant directly into your heart, and your body is essentially harvested as like a seed for, as essentially as soil for a tree to grow that will then be turned into food. And yeah, and an interesting little detail is that the leaves of these trees have the fingerprints of the people. So there's some really interesting and really creative world building going on here. It feels like classic sort of, you know, sci-fi literature, like your Asimovs or your Philip K. Dick sort of stuff. And what I found most fascinating about the film, not just in terms of the form, because the animation, it has a, like sort of these 3D, they sort of like almost look like they were designed in like a video game engine, like very sort of these 3D environments. And then all of the characters and like sort of all of the organic material, I guess, in the film is all like rotoscope, 2D rotoscope animation. And it just adds to this sort of otherworldly sort of alien, like almost like this dystopian and in certain areas, like utopian environment that this film is going for. And what I really loved about this film is that, you know, it has all of that great sci-fi sort of world building into it, but then it evolves into something a bit more emotionally complex, where by the end of the film, I was, you know, quite profoundly moved by this film. So within that setup, it also follows a young couple who are just on, who basically just passed the halfway mark. The man is 28 and the woman is 32. The woman, they've faced a tragedy in their lives, and the woman has put her hand up to voluntarily take the seed 18 years early and is then taken, essentially committing suicide to go to the plantation and be a sacrifice for the continuity of the species. And much to the husband's dismay and shock, he then goes on a quest to try to go to the plantation and save her. And there's a lot of great things that happen along the way that I don't really want to get into, because that'll be a spoiler. But, you know, this film tackles a lot of really things. It really becomes this emotionally complex sort of relationship drama in a sci-fi setting. And, you know, it almost disguises it that way. And I love movies that can do something, that can do things like that. And I was, as I said, profoundly moved by this film by the end. And, you know, I think, you know, it's addressing things like climate change. It's addressing things like, you know, like voluntary euthanasia, I guess, as well. Like, you could probably take that sort of reading into it. Yeah, I was, to see a film this good this early, I was very happy with it. So yeah, White Plastic Sky. And I'll also just quickly say, the session that I saw in this was a sensory-friendly session. That's a sort of initiative that I see a lot of cinemas have done, and that MIFF, the festival itself, have done, in terms of, like, you know, their accessibility coordinators have done. And myself, as a neurodivergent and autistic person, I never really have issues with that in a cinema. I actually find it engages me more. And I've been to a couple of sensory-friendly sessions by accident, but I didn't actually know that this was a sensory-friendly session, but this was the first one that I'd really been to where I feel like it actually, I'm not going to say enhanced the experience, but it really felt like something. I felt like the environment in which that I watched it in actually had an effect. So the lights were on, but like at its almost like the dimmest level, and the sound was actually down roughly 20%. And it actually, you know, it made for a really calming way to see the movie. And it's great that cinemas can do this sort of thing to help. I'm not going to say people like myself, but, you know, I am neurodivergent. So to say that, to help people like myself who, you know, have more difficulty with, you know, with these sorts of sensory issues in a cinema, that the festival can cater to them is fantastic. And the fact that they're doing it for a film as good as White Plastic Sky is just, you know, a cherry on top of that. And the final film I'm going to be talking about on this episode is another film starring MIFF's golden boy of this festival, Franz Rogowski, who was in the previously mentioned Passages. This is a film called Disco Boy, which has a bit of a misleading title, even though that is a titular line that is dropped at one point in the film. Franz Rogowski in this film plays a Belarusian man who is desperate to flee his country. Not sure if this is sort of set during the war and if he's sort of escaping that. The film never really establishes that, but he's fleeing Belarus regardless. He does make it into France, but his friend does die along the way. So with nowhere to go and threatened to be deported, he gets thrown a lifeline by the French Foreign Legion with a chance to prove himself, and with 5 years service can earn a French passport. And on the other side of this sort of thing, there's sort of two parallel stories that eventually intertwine and then become one, essentially. But then this other one on the sort of, just on the other side of the world, you've got a soldier who's the leader of this militia in Nigeria. And as I said, the two sort of cross paths in both physically and also sort of cosmic, potentially even supernatural ways. This is a really fascinating film. The best way that I can describe this is that it's Claire Denise Beautrevet mixed with Nadav Lapid's Synonyms, and then with a little bit of a little sprinkling of sort of African mysticism, which may or may not be a very bad example of exoticizing or othering this culture that they're showing on screen. But I think it's a really, really just a strange mix that I haven't seen in a film before. And I think the filmmaker here pulls it off quite well. And yeah, he's blessed that he has the great Franz Rogowski at his disposal here in this film, while watching this, I finally figured out that, oh, he is Germany's answer to Joaquin Phoenix. The two have very sort of similar striking features, not just in physically with the eyes and they even both have a cleft lip as well. But I think it's just the sort of intensity that they bring to the film that can switch from both incredibly tense and serious to very, I guess, light, jovial, and even at times a little bit creepy. you know, and I think, yeah, I think he's phenomenal in this film. You know, as I said earlier, it borrows heavily from Claire Denis' Beau Travail, but I feel like this film does enough. It has enough of other things to sort of stand on its own. Like, it, I don't think it quite holds a candle to, you know, Claire Denis' masterpiece that is Beau Travail, but I feel like this film is sort of saying similar things about, you know, the France's role in colonialism, you know, sort of the guilt surrounding that from Franz Rogowski's character, and also a film about identity as well, and finding that. I think it's a really, really interesting film that is sort of getting middling, it seems to be splitting a lot of people. I've found from discussions over the festival, this is the one that has a lot of people split. Not that it's either love or hate, but, like, I'm finding a lot of people are middling on it, but, like, it's probably has the most dynamic range of myth film so far in terms of what people thought of it. So I definitely recommend you to go and check it out for yourself. As of the time of recording, there is 2 sessions left playing at the festival. If you are actually in Geelong, it is playing at the Pivotonian Cinema. That is the one that is right next to the GMHBA Stadium, home of the mighty Geelong Cats. Let's hope that they can make us late charge into the finals as we come around to September. That would be fantastic. Yeah, so that again is happening on Sunday the 13th of August at 6:45. And back in Melbourne, there's another screening, which is currently at selling fast, so get your tickets in quick. That is on Sunday the 19th of August at 9:30 p.m. at the Kino Cinemas on Collins Street. So yeah, make sure you get around and check out Disco Boy. We're gonna leave it there just for this episode. Stick around during for the rest of the festival, as I'll probably do more of these sort of little bite-sized episodes where I talk about maybe five, six, you know, half a dozen, maybe even a dozen films, if I can sort of just quickly fire through them and just give sort of brief, like, thoughts. They're not going to be, like, straight out of the cinema. They're going to be, you know, but the thing is, when you're just cramming this many movies into your head, that you're not going to remember all of them. And I apologize for that, but I'm committing to this now. You know, I tried to do this a couple of years ago in 2019. I got burnt out pretty quickly doing that, and eventually just all sort of condensed the recordings that I did have into one big episode. But I'm going to try and commit to it this year. So make sure you stay subscribed wherever you get your podcast, and listen out for more episodes during MIF. All of the socials and everything will be in the description. So you won't have to hear me read those out anymore. Just look in the description and find all of them there. And thank you all very much for listening. And if you're coming along the ride with MIF, you know, have a great festival. And I hope you see some great films, and make sure you're listening in to what I thought of the films, and also, you know, get in contact with the show through the social medias, through our email, about what you've thought of the festival. And yeah, we'll leave it there, because I've got more movies to watch. Actually, no, I've got to go to bed and then and then have more movies to watch. The festivals never stop, movies never stop, movies will live forever. Thanks very much for listening, guys, and until next time, we will see you later.